Thank you for coming. It is 2 p.m. and we should get this panel on the road. Wow. Thank you for packing the auditorium as well. My name is Arun. I'm going to moderate this all-star group of panelists from Microsoft, the IE group, from Mozilla, guys behind Firefox, and from Opera. But before I do, I just want to state a few biases. There's one involuntary bias that I have no control over that has been introduced into this panel, and that is that Apple won't send anybody to play with us. They're a very secretive company, and I have the utmost admiration for them. You know, as I walk through the Austin Convention Center, everybody has a MacBook Pro. There's a lot of iPhones in everybody's pocket. Somebody's using Safari. It's just that, you know, their corporate culture is such that while they can participate in standards, they just won't come to a panel like this. And to their credit, last year when we did this panel, PC Magazine did a bit of a write-up. So if they were paranoid last year, they must be even more paranoid this year. The good news is we can talk smack about them and they can't defend themselves. The other bias is my own bias in calling together the panel. And that is basically the simple question about what is a browser. Flock isn't on this panel. PC Magazine also did a write-up about how browsers are becoming boring, how the IE8 beta doesn't introduce anything new. But for me, what I really want, and the people that I really want to talk to, are the people that are doing the stuff that you are building stuff on top of. The APIs, the markup set, the new features, the implementation for CSS, all that kind of stuff. So that is what I mean by browsers. And I'm sorry that Apple can't make it, but let's get rolling. Audience participation is key here. That's what made it magical last time. There is a microphone at the back, so if you think you have a question festering, angle yourself so you can get close to that microphone, and your question will probably be recorded. I'll watch the time like a hawk and leave plenty of time for you guys. I'll ask some teaser questions to get started. But first, let me introduce these guys. To my right, and I'm fond of saying, this is Brendan Eich. He's a classical pianist, and he also invented JavaScript. To his right is Chris Wilson. Chris Wilson is a scuba diver and ocean photographer, and he's also worked on every version of IE that you've used. And to his right is Charles McCarthy Neville, who reads a book a week and travels all over the world in the name of standards. He's also Opera's chief standards officer. So panelists, take it away. Let's start with Brendan, and then we'll move down the line.
Hello. I don't know what to say. It seems like the war hype worked. Is that why you're all here? You want to see a fight? I'm here for the cause of peace. So you don't want me. Next.
I think I'll go along with Brendan. I think I'm sure that there is a lot of controversy. We certainly do have disagreements occasionally. I think Brendan and I have had a few. But I think we all do really just want to get along. So.
So I'm kind of on that line, and I'm kind of not. There is a war. You know, we represent three different products, and we're trying to build things that are better. You know, we want to build a better browser than any of these guys, right? The important bit, I think, is to actually make sure that we get along where it matters. So we all sit inside our company and build better browsers and build new stuff. What we're trying to do in the new browser wars is make sure that the battleground is the browser's quality and how it supports the user, rather than trying to carve up the web into eight different spaces where you can only play with one guy's products.
Great. I this is another bias. I use the term war to pack the auditorium, but in all honesty, two of these companies are in court in Europe. Again, an antitrust kind of court case. And two of these guys have divergent opinions on where technology is going. And of course it gets personal sometimes. And divergent technology opinions are what makes this interesting. So here's my first question. And I'm going to throw this one at Chris. Chris, you've just come back from Vegas where MixO8 took place, which is Microsoft's big developer outreach conference. And in it, you know, Steve Ballmer got up and ran around on stage reprising his monkey boy role. And you can look on YouTube and look for Dance Monkey Boy Dance. It's Steve Ballmer, really.
There's about 50 copies of it, I think. Yeah.
Right. But
easy to find.
But what he was yelling was, web developers, web developers, web developers. And so IE is all about web developers, but at the same time, if you look at the MixOS 8 agenda, you're really pitching Silverlight, which is a set of technologies that is web-like, does cool stuff, works in IE just like anything else, but is not what is the web exactly. So what is your outreach message to Silverlight? And I should point out that Chris Wilson does wear two hats. He is also the chair of the HTML5 working group, and he also worked on the antecedents co-chair. And he also worked on the antecedents of what is Silverlight today in terms of Avalon and stuff like that. So he's done it all, and he's seen where his company can take the web. Silverlight is proprietary. So what are your thoughts on what the real message to web developers is from you guys?
So I think the first thing that I'd say, Arun, is that what you're talking about is the thing that I'm really passionate about, which is the web standards platform, right? Like HTML, CSS, JavaScript, the DOM, all that stuff put together as a platform. That's what I do. Like, that really is what I focus most of my day on. I'm not on the Silverlight team. Like, I've looked at it. It's a good product. It's a nice platform. I do think that it's part of the web in the same way that competing products to that are part of the web, the same way that PDF is part of the web, plain text is part of the web. But that doesn't mean that that's the standards-based platform. That's not the platform that I go and build on a daily basis. Like, that's not why I'm here, I guess, to talk about Silverlight.
Okay. Fair enough, but hold that thought, because
Brendan looks like he wants to.
Yes,
say something.
I detect it.
I can feel it.
Yes.
Actually, it's coming off.
So PDF has been open spec since 1.0, and nobody has patents on text plain. So Silverlight is not quite on the same footing, in my opinion. It's nice, and it's cool that you're taking on Flash. It'll take years. It could be done. Some of the tools look really good. Flash kind of parried on the video front by doing Flash 9 Update 3, but, you know, the war goes on. But that's, to me, that's kind of the web, but not quite. And I'm not talking about this like some standard snob. I talk to users, and they get into a Flash or a Silverlight setting where it takes over the whole page, and they think they're being owned by some hack. You know, they think it's an exploit. It doesn't feel quite right. Maybe the accessibility doesn't work right. It's kind of cool. You feel like you're in a game, like a computer game. But to me, it's a little bit different from the web. The hyperlinks don't all work the way you want them to. It's a little bit second class still. Now, that may get fixed over time. But my way of fixing it is to just uplift the web so that it can do all those things without running into patent minefields.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's why I'm on the IE platform team and not on the Silverlight team or the WPF team anymore, is to drive that and is to uplift that platform. At the same time, I'd point out, like, the reason why we went off and started the whole WPF Avalon project was we'd taken the web platform that we had, the HTML, CSS, JavaScript platform, to a point where we started running into a bunch of scalability problems. And some of those, frankly, you know, they're problems that were solvable, and we just didn't know how to solve them at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, we're solving a bunch of those now. But at the same time, some of those problems were, well, it is hard to tool a platform that's built that way. And that's why the way that WPF does componentization is radically different mm-hmm. from the way that the web platform did. Because that strategy, if you're a certain type of developer, if you're trying to build applications in a certain way, or frameworks in a certain way, it's easier, right? It's more toolable that way.
Mm-hmm. Has anybody here used Aptana? Or there's some hands going up. People know what that is. So you're right. There's a belief about how to tool for certain content languages, but I think the web can handle those too.
Yeah, I mean, Aptana is a great example of a good tool that wasn't there, you know, 5-8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And seeing more tools like that are targeting the standards-based platform, I personally find really exciting, because I do think that helps exactly what you're talking about.
Right, okay. So a lot of the magic and the promise of technologies like that are that the desktop and the web will merge and do cooler things and stuff like that. Now, Charles, all of these guys have a vision for that, for the extending of the browser, whether it's Firefox extensions, in the case of IE, whether it's Silverlight. But Opera does something particularly interesting. Everything that it even conceives of doing, it tries to standardize, including the widget spec. There's nothing proprietary. You want to put everything out in the open. And that's been something that, I mean, that's particularly your job at working groups and other things. You travel touting the message of openness and having developers coalesce around one way of doing things. What's your take on all this?
It needs to be in the open, you know, Brendan famously said something that wasn't actually, you know, the mobile web will never happen. The mobile web, you know, the device web, the web on checkout machines was one of our recent odd places to put a web browser, does happen. And when you build applications, the problem with building them in a platform like Silverlight, in a platform like Flash, where you're relying on getting this platform available in your set of devices, means you're waiting for one company to do what it is you want. The web is, you know, far and away the best distributed technology. HTML, SVG, CSS, JavaScript, that stuff's available on just bazillions of devices of all kinds. No one company is going, you know, Opera, we pride ourselves at putting the web everywhere. And there are devices we don't put the web on, right? We don't have an iPhone browser yet, for example. But making sure that you have open standards and making sure that those are web standards is the only way that you can seriously offer that platform, that power to developers to build their applications and put them anywhere they want. To be able to build applications that actually work for all of the users that they want to go out and get. And you said, you know, you wanted the panel to be the people who are building the technology that all of you guys are out building on. And I think it's important that that's actually a panel. You know, no one company should be the provider that all of you guys are hanging on and hoping they'll do your thing. If you've got open standards development, if you've got this ability for different companies to compete on the quality of how they implement the standards, but make sure that each company is actually putting out stuff that works together, then you've got a platform.
Yeah. So actually, let me just hold on to that notion of standards. Brendan, you invented JavaScript, and to this day, you're sort of one of the custodians of it in that you're the chair of a working group, you're interested in new features to JavaScript. In fact, ECMAScript 4 will introduce new things and will actually, some people think it'll be a new language. You also called Chris a liar in the blog.
No,
here.
I didn't.
You did. And
no, you're not quoting me. I said that Chris was repeating lies, falsehoods knowingly.
Okay. Thank you. But for those that are...
Chris is not a journalist.
Okay, fair enough.
I think he was saying I wasn't smart enough to lie.
No, I didn't say that either.
No, but wait. You took the gloves off and you hit hard, and I want to make sure that the audience understands the contention. I mentioned Silverlight for a reason, and I mentioned JavaScript for a reason. Silverlight tends to view C# as a first-class citizen, and you can write cool stuff in C#, and I'm sure some of you have taken a look at C#, which is a Microsoft language that does work on other things. The contention is that Microsoft wants to not really see JavaScript spread its wings and fly, but wants to hone and refine C#. That's the juicy bit of the argument. Of course, I'm simplifying, but that's the piece that I want you guys to sink your teeth into. So I let Brendan take a chomp, and I let Chris take a counter chomp.
It's kind of silly because for a year and a half or more, we had public meeting minutes up, published, I think, with the consent of everyone working in the ECMA group. And you can go read them, and they're a little tedious, and you have to go through all the boilerplate. But neilmix.com is where Neil Mix, who works on Pandora, blogged a quick way to diagram what happened. And it looked a lot like Microsoft showed up in 2006, and their guy said, yeah, we're going to do it great. We're going to join with ECMA and implement the next version. We already have a prototype in jscript.net. And everything seemed hunky-dory until early 2007 when things started turning around. And it looked like maybe he was making decisions above his pay grade and got turned around by his bosses. And things did get a little unpleasant after that. But again, what we're trying to do is evolve JavaScript to meet the use cases that its programmers run into every day. And I believe people at Microsoft want to work on standards and improve them. But if you look at Silverlight, you look at the stack, not just C#, but all the other languages that run in the CLR and the DLR, it's compelling. And if you were willing to jump from the web in the first class way I talked about to Silverlight, you could realize some real benefits. Microsoft has a lot of skills there. And they have a lot of market power to push Silverlight through Windows updates. So there is obviously a struggle inside Microsoft, I would say, and in reality, between advancing things like JavaScript and kind of working harder on those things that Microsoft already owns, like C# and .NET. And I know people at Microsoft, it's a house divided. I hear different people. Some of them are the worst kind of reactionaries. They remind you of Talleyrand's remark about the Bourbons trying to repeal the French Revolution remotely from Venice, that they have learned
that
nothing.
That was an esoteric reference.
Wait for the quote. They have learned nothing and forgotten nothing. You know, they want to go back to 1995 and play by the old book. And there are other people, like I'm sure Chris, who want to advance standards, but it's not a clean story. It's not like they're all putting their energy behind the standards-based web. They're putting standards behind energy behind different things, like Silverlight.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that Microsoft is a very big company, and we have a lot of projects, and we do put some of our energy behind products that are not purely standards-based. IE is, I hope, not one of those.
Cross-domain request.
We'll get to that. Wait for it. Just wait for it. I think a lot of the controversy about ECMAScript 4 kind of stemmed from... It was kind of interesting because I got asked my opinion by Dean Edwards, and I stated it, and that quickly, of course, you know, I should have expected, turned into the voice of Microsoft, and it wasn't really intended to be. It was my opinion. I think really the controversy there, though, was really not around whether JavaScript should evolve, because I think Brendan and I certainly both agree, I'm sure, that it should. I think the controversy was around how and what it should evolve into and what it should be. And I think that even the ECMAScript 4 proposal that has been built for the last couple of years, you know, that may be a good language. The question was whether that's really what developers are going to consider JavaScript or not, or whether that is a new language, and whether you do really want to go head-to-head with C#. Hey, great, go for it. Not really sure whether you're going to take on the same scenarios or not.
Definitely not. I mean, anything you do against something as big as Microsoft has to be fourth generation warfare. It has to be leveraged. It has to be guerrilla warfare. Sorry. I don't want to say something politically incorrect, but it's true. Firefox is a mass movement. We wouldn't have succeeded without people voluntarily downloading and switching browsers. Some number of them actually help market it, some test it, some hack on it. And that's far more than any one company could do. And we owe it all to them. And that is not traditional head-to-head, you know, Adobe versus Microsoft, let's say, competition. That's the new model that we're trying to push.
Sure. But, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I think that our disagreement around the future of JavaScript was not whether JavaScript has a future or whether it should evolve, but more around what things it should evolve to take on and when. To me, like, the security in the language is probably the most interesting thing given the history and experience we've been having on the browser. Like, anything we can do to make building mashups and building applications in that system more secure, the better off I think we're going to be. And that's not really the core area that you've been taking on.
How could I disagree? Except that security goes beyond the programming language. You cannot have a secure programming language.
Absolutely
true. It's an end-to-end property of systems. And we're not going to solve it by making JavaScript more secure. There's a school of thought that says stop the world, make the language more secure, fix security, and then you can go back to improving the language otherwise. But that's unreal. It isn't how people work. It isn't how security is achieved. And it isn't how security in Silverlight is achieved. So I don't think we're going to do that. What I would say about JavaScript 2 is it's happening now, ECMAScript 4. It's going forward into a phase where you can actually download a reference implementation and pieces of it are showing up in products, and there's going to be more of that. And before it's standardized, before we get out the rubber stamp that ECMA last used on OOXML, we're going to make sure that it actually does work for developers. So we're not going to rush it through.
Okay. That's fair enough. Let me steer the direction to something else for a second and pick on Charles. Charles, this is a question on mobile devices. Actually, a lot of what makes Opera really cool is that it actually brought my crappy Razer to life. Like, once I had Opera Mini on it, I could actually do useful things with my Razer. But I now use the iPhone, on which I can only use Safari, and they'll never come and talk to me. And if I buy a Windows mobile device, I would probably use Compact IE or Pocket IE, but I could use Opera on it because it's a more open development platform. For a while, I could have used Minimo, so I actually want to ask you what Firefox Mobile is going later, Brendan, but this is for Charles. Charles, Opera puts browsers on all kinds of phones, like ridiculous sometimes, with the little J2ME midlet that isn't really a browser but sends messages to a server and makes the web work. There's just a lot of hard work in doing that. But you don't get distribution deals because those devices come with their own thing on it. I mean, what's the game here? Like, how are you, why do you guys work so hard, and what does Opera see happening? And feel free to beat up on the iPhone, because they can't say anything in their defense. Like, they've released an SDK, and I'm sure Opera would like to be on the iPhone. What are you trying to do?
So, yeah, the iPhone's a pretty good browser if you don't want to ever hit the back button. Yeah, they set a new standard in UIs, right, for mobile browsing. If you get Opera Mini and you have a look at what Opera Mini does, we don't have the bouncy effect. It's like, I'm sure that changes people's browsing experience pretty significantly. But we do have a cursor, so you can actually do a hover and stuff. I want to argue with a couple of things you said. Mini is a browser. When you've got your razor in your hand, you start up the application, and you've got a browser, right? It goes out, it does the web, it runs web applications, it does Ajax stuff, you can do things on the web. That's what a browser is, in my mind. If it, if it walks like a browser and smells like a browser, it's a duck. Opera actually does get distribution deals. I mean, if you go out and buy a new HTC device, for example, they're the biggest Windows Mobile OEM, then they're shipping Opera on devices as the default browser. It's like, I have a Sony Ericsson phone, and the browser on that is Opera. It's because these manufacturers go out, look at the browsers available, and it's, we're sort of three of Arun's four browser companies, but you could have picked on Nokia, you could have called up Access, or InfraWare, or any of dozens of browser, OpenWave. There's a lot more browsers out there. The mobile space is a bit different, because people actually do go out, OEMs go out and say, well, what's the best browser? We're going to put a browser on for a couple of years, we'll make a deal, and they shift, and they swap, and they change. So in one sense, it's much more open than the desktop. That makes it a nice place to compete. You just go out and build a better browser, and start shipping it. So I think that's really important. For us, it's also important that the mobile space is just part of the browsing world. If you've got Mini 4, you can do the desktop view, where you get the overview and the magic zoom in, and zoom out, or you can do an adaptation that's built into the browser. These are different ways of accessing the same stuff. And I think that's important, that, again, as I said before, the idea is, if you're out there building an application, you want to make your millions by having users, right? You want your users to be able to use whatever it is they've got in their pocket. So we're not about to build an iPhone browser, I don't think, because iPhone ships, 2 million-odd, 3 million handsets maybe? We shipped 40 million copies of Opera Mobile last year. So other platforms are actually more interesting. They're more open, as you said. Windows Mobile is a much more open platform, and you can choose what you want. Users can choose, operators choose, OEMs choose. I think that's the way the market ought to be, right? I mean, that you alluded to the antitrust complaint, which is not quite a court case between us. But it's about actually opening that space. It's about having an open platform and an open market where people can compete on the quality of their browser, not on who their shipping deal is with.
But Charles, how many people choose their browser on mobile platforms? Do you have numbers for Opera? I know Mini's done well, but you look at a lot of the deals where you say you're on the device because of the handset maker or the carrier. That seems to be the number one way to get users to use your browser. It's not that they download it like Firefox on the desktop.
So I think that's changing. Mini has something like 40 million downloads, people going out and downloading it. So that's quite a lot of people choosing for a market that doesn't exist because no one will ever browse on mobiles.
Another risk quote. So last year I was here and I said that the web doesn't fit on mobile phones, and somebody put a picture up of a guy with like a sandwich board with a computer, a desktop computer rigged to it, and said that was Mozilla's vision of the mobile web. And I got the first question I think that I was responding to was actually Daniel Applequist from Vodafone, so there's a vested interest for you. But I think it's true. I think this changed the game a little bit, but I still browse on this, and I have to pinch it and get the text to be readable instead of, you know, eye-bleeding tiny. There are real differences between the devices that I was referring to a year ago that still make it a little bit difficult for your, you know, millions of dollars making website to really get users and have them stick and have them like it. But it's getting a lot better, and it's really cool because it's on the go. And if it only had tactile feedback, like Chris was saying before our panel here.
And a back button.
It'd be even easier. Because I've made some embarrassing
fat fingers.
And a
user-replaceable battery.
Oh, no, that would ruin the look. it's got to be smooth. It's got to be like this little thing in your shower.
but, it's not waterproof, right?
No. Darn. But so the situation's fluid, and it's getting better, but it's still a potential breaking point for the web, where you'll get the mobile web versus the real web. And that's the kind of tension we've had for a long time. That's why there were these bogus standards, in my opinion, like, you know, WAP, to try to make the mobile web and fork all the content in the web into two copies, one that was written for devices and one that wasn't. So it's cool that we're moving toward a single web again. We're not there, but just for the record, we're very interested in mobile. It's the growth curves are just too big, and people do use these devices a lot on the go. I use them, and it should be possible, without having to use a back button or mistype things, to have these things really be good web browsers.
So I want to make a couple of comments on that. I mean, we're in the country where when you're on the go, that means you're sitting in your Hummer, right? On your own. When you're on
the
go,
what do they drive in Australia?
When you're on the go in Japan, that means you're standing, you know, one hand holding the strap, half asleep, with your phone, you know, using the web. It's actually a lot more common in other places. You find Japan is a place that has a pretty high degree of web usage for a developed country. When you go into the developing world, you know, I was talking last night to someone. China's got an internet market of about 200 million users, right? That's about the same as the internet market in the US. But China's got a little bit of room left for growth after those 200 million. India's pretty similar. People aren't going out and buying desktop devices. If you haven't got a power supply that's reliable, and you haven't got a steady fixed line network that's reliable, and the desktop is actually a fairly expensive device, and you can put Opera Mini on a $50 phone, then that's what people use. That's the only way they use the web. So for those people, it's not a question of, you know, how much more or less comfortable is it. It's about what can I afford? What can I carry on a boat, on a bicycle, and use? Because that's their life. That's hundreds of millions of users. So that's one side. The other side is, I agree. For me, you know, browsing on a phone and browsing on a desktop, it's different. There's stuff I'm not going to do on my phone. There's stuff I sit down at, do it on my desktop, link it back to my phone later, because it's more comfortable. But there's times when I'm on the go. There's times when I want a mobile web, and the applications are the same applications. They should work. So, you know, one of the other things iPhone doesn't do is let you have any kind of, you know, Apple came out and said, the iPhone, it's Safari, it's the real web. And then they went to all the developers and said, by the way, you should make special iPhone-only websites. It's like, come on, guys.
Did they really say that?
You can't have it both ways, right? There are ways of making the web adapt, really simply, to mobile devices. Apple sort of skipped all those and came up with the hard ways instead. You know, you can make stuff that adapts nicely and adapts to other things, but they didn't give you the easy ones, all of the hard things that work on Mini, that work on, you know, lots of different browsers, are available. The simple stuff is actually available. You know, people have been looking at this. The CSS group, you know, put out, when did CSS 2 come out, Chris? Like
99.
That was kind of where I first ran across Chris Wilson.
Something.
And they had already built in, you know, simple ways to adapt content to mobiles. Why doesn't iPhone do that?
I think the real question is, why don't web developers do that?
Yeah.
Right, that I'm sure is the problem they run into. And certainly there are plenty of sites that are built very, very adaptably. And some of them work great. Like I've been playing a lot with this because of the page zooming that we're doing in IE, and seeing how different sites adapt or don't adapt. Some of them are great. Web Standards Project, adapts really well. W3C adapts really well. A bunch of other sites, not so well. And yes, a number of them are Microsoft properties. But the reason that they do that is for a particular look and feel, right? They want it to look exactly that way, and they just haven't been educated on how to build that in an adaptable way yet, because people do still have the mindset of, oh, I've got an 800 by 600 screen, or I guess now it's 1024 by 768, because we've all upgraded. I mean, that's pragmatic, I think, is the problem.
But except it's not very pragmatic, because you haven't got an 800 by 600 or a 1024.
Certainly not as you know, the adoption of mobile devices and other form factors has skyrocketed, yeah. Not anymore.
Anyway, I've been asked to pester you guys to speak a bit closer to your microphones, so let's bear that in mind. Brendan, with Firefox going on mobile devices, the first incarnation was Minimo, in which you could do tab browsing, you could do extensions and stuff like that. Now Mozilla has a group working in Copenhagen in Denmark, and they're all about working on mobile browsers, putting Firefox on mobile devices. Is there anything you can do to shed some light on what you guys are doing and what the vision is, and can you do extensions and all that cool Firefox stuff on mobile devices?
Sure. Part of the vision would be to support add-ons and not different from the desktop ones. Not all the ones in the desktop make sense or will fit, but it should be possible, just like Charles and Chris were saying, to write the same content and have it adapt through CSS and through other means to the scale of the device's display. And we're very interested in that. I mean, this is great, but it's not going to be extensible in that way. It's pretty clear. Firefox should be just as extensible on devices as it can be on the desktop. And that's going to be a big focus. We've also gotten smaller. Minimo was like taking, you know, Mozilla code back when we were still under AOL's ownership, and you know, putting the the 200-pound lady in the size 2 dress didn't quite work. Firefox has gotten smaller, Gecko's gotten smaller, and the devices have gotten more capable, and that's been big for users and developers as well as for us.
Okay. I actually now want to stray away from mobile. And in a couple of minutes, I'm going to ask audience questions. But this is for Chris. Chris, you get beat up a lot and picked on a lot, whether it's a blogosphere contention between you guys or whether it's in your role as co-chair of the HTML working group. This is HTML5, the next generation of HTML. If you go to the HTML5 webpage on the W3C site, it actually says, this is designed to be an open standards technology, unlike Silverlight. You are co-chair of that working group. So, you know, wearing your hat as co-chair of that working group, you sometimes had to say, Microsoft has to halt proceedings to do a patent scrub before we can even do this. It's a messy, messy thing. There's a lot of people participating. What's going on with HTML5 co-chair Chris Wilson?
Wow. I'm not sure I can actually detail what's going on in HTML5 in the remaining 25 minutes. Certainly, you know, looking at HTML5 and the breadth of everything that's in there, it is a somewhat chaotic effort right now. I think pretty much everyone would agree with that. But there are a lot of really good pieces going into that, and there's a lot of great contributions going into that. Looking at the breadth of just areas that are getting attacked in there, that's pretty exciting. And like I said, if I detailed them, we would chew up the rest of the time. Certainly, not everything in there is something that I personally agree with. It's not a standard yet, right? It's not a recommendation of the W3C yet. We do still have a lot more discussion and a lot more work to do.
Okay. I accept that answer because, I mean, I can
whip out the list of things that is in HTML5 and we can discuss each of them.
No, but in particular, is Canvas back on and will you guys think about it seriously?
Well, Canvas is in. It's never actually been taken out of the HTML5 specification.
Right.
But I think that I have a concern, actually, an ongoing concern with making sure that we carefully follow the policies of the W3C and making sure that we're actually adhering to our charter. And if we want to amend our charter, great, we should. That's still a problem for me, just because we have to plan for what's going into it so that we know what we're contributing and what areas we have to investigate. and do due diligence on for ourselves to implement. I mean, and that isn't saying that protects us from everything, but at least we know what the risk is of signing up to any particular standard or any particular implementation area. For areas that are traditionally patent rich, that tends to concern us a bit. Like, we have to pay close attention to what we're implementing when someone may have patents and they may not be in the HTML working group, they may not be in the W3C, and I kind of know who they'll probably sue first when the implementations are out there. And so we do have to be cautious. That is why we're extra cautious about signing up for things like that.
Okay. And we also have another co-chair, Charles. Often the guy on stilts behind the wizard cloak of Ajax is this really primitive API in JavaScript called XML HTTP request. It just does a lot of things by brute force. A lot of cool web apps get built by it, but it's kind of this weird back-channel-y thing. The working group that Charles is co-chair of actually crafts the next generation of that, which actually means that where Ajax is going and some of the thinking on that comes out of that working group in some senses. What are the kinds of things with XML HTTP request and some of the specs that you guys are publishing that developers in the room can actually start looking forward to?
So the big thing is a spec, yeah, that's actually implemented. When we started out with the spec, everybody had XML HTTP request. Like, all the browsers did it in their own special way. And all the developers would sit down and try and figure out what that special way was. So we sat down to do the work of writing it up and figuring out something that we can all go and build a target for. We're not through with that process. You know, we've got a draft that's reasonably mature, reasonably solid in a lot of areas. There's still, there's a bunch of tests out there on the web. They're not official agreed tests yet, but sitting down with them shows there are still some really big differences. There are some questions that we've got to figure out. Well, which way are we all going to go? One of the things that's been nice is that Microsoft, earlier this year, finally actually came and sat down, ran through all the tests, and said, well, wait a minute, we don't do this and we don't do that and we don't do the other and we don't think this is a good idea. In some cases, they were quite right. There was stuff in the spec that was kind of odd, and sitting back and looking at it again with everybody participating, it's not clear why we chose that and maybe we should turn it over. That's how spec work happens, right? That's how you make a standard. So I think now we're at the stage where in the very near future we will have identified all of those issues or all the issues that come up in the real world and have some sense of a real solution to them. That's the first thing. Then there's the XML HTTP request 2 spec, which basically extends the power, which is looking at stuff like how do you choose whether you want to keep a live connection or not, looking at ideas like doing binary requests, which aren't available in XHR1 by any straightforward mechanism, looking at how you can do cross-site access in a way. The current proposal that has a fairly limited way of doing it, but it does actually advance what you can do. It does provide a certain way to open the security model that we think is safe enough to use so that you will be able to do some sets of cross-site requests under the right conditions. That's sort of where we're going with that.
It is now the time that I promised the audience that they could go and ask questions. So you can see a microphone at the back. There's also people sitting on the floor, so there'll probably be a little bit of shuffling. But please form a queue so I can see you, and please speak close to the microphone because I think they want to kind of record a lot of this session. So gentlemen at the mic.
Hi. Okay. I have a question for Chris regarding scalable vector graphics. Do you think that Silverlight means that IE cannot support scalable vector graphics? And since I guess you cannot talk a lot about this, could you shed some light on where you see scalable vector graphics in the open web? What kind of a standard is it? Because you didn't mention it as the standards that you're working on.
The question was on scalable vector graphics, or SVG, and IE's continued lack of support for them. Chris Wilson.
Pay your alimony, Chris.
I liked his question better. When his question was nicer. So, scalable vector graphics. I heard at least three questions in there, actually, and I can remember at least two of them. The first one was, having Silverlight mean that we can't implement scalable vector graphics? And no, of course, having Silverlight doesn't mean one way or another that we can or cannot implement scalable vector graphics. As for sort of the roadmap or where I see vector graphics fitting into IE and the web platform, it's certainly something that I want us to take on. One of the challenges, of course, that we have is when and how to do that and where that fits into our priority set. Looking at IE8, I think that we've chosen the right priorities of things. We've taken on the most important things first. That doesn't say that vector graphics isn't important. I do think that one of the challenges we have now also that's been introduced is there's more than one way to do vector graphics, and there's more than one way to do vector graphics interoperably and helping prioritize between, for example, Canvas from HTML5 and SVG, because there's actually multiple versions of SVG, and what's implemented in interoperable is really what we're trying to advance. So trying to figure out what the best thing for us to do next so that you do actually get an interoperable platform is what we're trying to accomplish.
Can you just explain a bit more about there's multiple versions of SVG? I mean, it's sure. Not that varied a space, right?
There's one spec that I once printed out, and it was like it had to be bound into two separate books because it was so thick. I don't think that's what you implement. Right? I think you implement SVG Tiny. And actually, the last time I checked, which granted was probably, 9 months or so ago, each of the browsers did a subtly different set of things. Like, I believe Opera was the only one who did animation other than object model animation.
Actually, all of the mobile browsers do that. The only ones that don't are Firefox and WebKit.
Yeah. So, moving right along, next question.
I'm going to have to side with Chris on this one. SVG is this mammoth spec. It has bugs. It has ambiguities. It has gaps. You can't say go implement all of it. I'm talking about 1.1, let's say. Even 1.1 tiny is big. And I'm glad Opera did it. It's great you've got Smile in there with all 57 namespaces or whatever it is. We're not going to do that. I don't think that's what developers actually want. They don't want every last detail. I don't know if other people notice this, but it seems to me whenever talk turns toward the standards process and the process and the process about the process, people's eyes glazed over. Mine did. There's something wrong here. We're putting the problem of making interoperable web content that works in different browsers through a standards process that tends to bloat it up and take 5 years and actually not deliver it. And that's no good. That just helps Silverlight do better. That just helps Flash do better. And I'm not a Flash hater, but to the extent that Flash proliferates, there's a monoculture, there's a single vendor solution, there's something that isn't quite the web. Like I said, it doesn't have quite the accessibility. Hyperlinks don't always work right. You need a plugin. So I would like to see the web standards go faster. And to do that, they need to work smarter. They need to be not super small. They need to be the right size. And SVG is not the right size. Sorry. So I agree with Chris. We should find the right subset that browsers implement that is important to developers.
Wait, gentlemen at the mic, please hold that thought. Brendan, you say you're not a Flash hater, but what's interesting about Mozilla is that a lot of the future scripting engine work is a contribution of the Adobe engine, which is going to be released, I think you call it Screaming Monkey, the next version of the JavaScript engine in Firefox and Mozilla browsers. It will be based on a donation of an open source scripting engine from Adobe. Mm-hmm. Isn't that like strange bedfellows?
Not really. It was before Adobe acquired Macromedia that we were working with Macromedia on improving plugin APIs, along with Opera and Apple and Real and others. We also were working with Adobe in that group and Sun. We also started working on ECMA standards before I think Microsoft really rejoined or was back from vacation or whatever happened. This was like 2004, 2005. So we were working really well with the Macromedia guys. Opera joined in, and we got a small group working well on an evolution of JavaScript. And at the same time, or even before that, Macromedia had implemented this faster, high-performance virtual machine for an evolved version of JavaScript called ActionScript that's in Flash. So to the extent we were doing technical work that we thought was high quality, relevant to developers, we had a common interest. And that's how I think great standards are made. You don't try to get things done by one company only. You don't have strange bedfellows doing backroom deals. You try to put the common elements through a standards process that's relatively lightweight, and that's what ECMO was at the time.
But how many people in the room are Flash developers? That's actually good to see. So I mean, that's an interesting Uber point, which is that the action scripting language and the JavaScripting engine and JavaScript are sort of have totally coalesced, and you know, you guys have the same engine. Chris, I interrupted you.
Oh, I'm just, that still seems like your question was valid. Just replace Adobe with Macromedia.
But it's not strange bedfellows if you're working on something that is of interest to developers, where you can support the same code more or less working in browsers and in Flash. That helps unify the web. That helps get rid of the second-class nature of Flash, in my opinion. And if you do more of that over time, and Macromedia and now Adobe are doing that, they're opening up pieces of it like Flex, you do converge Flash on the open web, and I would like to see that happen. It's going to take years, and there are patent minefields.
So you get sort of ECMAScript 4, which actually pretty much unifies, you know, the Flash idea of scripting and JavaScript, and you get SVG, which pretty much unifies the graphics, and you get HTML. And then Flash becomes a first-class web citizen because it's just the web, right?
It's not smile-based animation, I'll tell you that.
Okay, gentlemen at the mic.
Okay, my name is Jacob Robbins. I'm a web developer at a startup company. There's two issues that have forced use of Flash, both at this gig and the previous one, and they are allowing the user to select multiple files for upload at once and playing back a little MP3 clip and a little player. Is there any way to do those in a standards-based way upcoming, or I'm just wondering why those are an issue?
So in the Web API group, which I chair, there's a trailing action item for a spec called file upload.
We can't pick on the moderator.
There is a draft, right?
We had a guy working for AOL who was responsible for, you know, redrafting that spec.
This program has been interrupted.
Get on it, Arun. Come on.
So, you know, part of the problem with the standards process is it is based on participation. You know, it's based on people having the time to do stuff. And apparently the guy was really busy, you know, taking an extended vacation.
It's just a slacker.
He was doing panels.
Moderating panels, you know, running around being a rock star.
Okay, does that answer your question? I'm kidding.
Opera is actually probably going to end up putting up our spec as a new draft for that. It is a known, you know, lack in the web as the sort of first-class web. It is an API that people need, and we'll figure out a way to do it within the group. If you want to sit down and write up the API or edit the API and, you know, deal with all of the different ideas that come in and figure out how to make them work with each other.
Charles has a bridge to sell you.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. Coat hanger shape.
What was your other question? Sorry.
Playback of MP3s and little...
Playback of sounds and media.
Yeah. So, you know, HTML5 has this work on audio, on video. SVG mm-hmm. already has. SVG 1.2 Tiny does audio and video. You know, it's pretty straightforward. You have an audio element, a video element. And you put
SVG.
Something in. There's still in there a patent war, right? There's still a question about what formats are going to go into what devices. Because when you go out and buy a phone, you pay to have a particular video decoder on it. And when you buy a different phone, you pay for a different video decoder. That's a battle that Chris and Dan Connolly have probably got some experience with in HTML. Yeah, we'll see where that goes. It's not that hard technically. You can use audio APIs in quite a lot of browsers. It's not that far from being interoperable, but it's not really well documented. It's not properly spec'd, and it's not standardized yet.
MP3 is going to be unencumbered some short number of years, right? I don't keep track of these things, but there's always the next format that's popular, and they're encumbered.
What do you mean by that, unencumbered?
The patents... I'm not sure what the story is exactly, but
at some point patents run out. Yeah, I think is what Brendan's getting.
You won't have to pay a license to implement them.
So, you know, if you talk about MPEG 4 video, you're still paying hefty licensing fees to the MPEG licensing authority. In this year and next, it went up to $10 million cap per year per company, from $5 million last year. So,
Another question at the mic.
Hi, I'm David Carlson from the University of Florida. I have a very low-tech question, but one that I think might improve the lives of millions, and that is, what would it take to get you guys to agree on how to parse CSS padding and margins?
Taxes.
Standards taxes.
So what would it take for us to agree on what wow, okay.
There's a spec.
There's a spec. I think that really you're probably asking, when are we going to follow the spec? Certainly, particularly with layout in IE8, you know, we spent a tremendous amount of time during the IE8 cycle building a new layout engine from the ground up with actually a copy of the CSS 2.1 draft in hand. Like, we made a copy for each of our developers, so they all had one right at their desk. I would hope that we're actually headed towards that. And if not, we've got a beta out. Please test it. Please tell us when it's not right, because we do actually want to know so we can try to fix it before we ship. Other than that, I'm not sure there's that many interoperability problems between the rest of you guys.
I don't. Yeah, that's it. What it actually takes is for the browsers and the developers to sit down and talk to each other in their development process. You know, a very small flame war burst out recently in a sort of piece of accessibility stuff. Microsoft put out their first beta. They'd done ARIA, which is a spec to support accessibility to make, you know, rich applications accessible. It's great stuff. One of the guys that works for me, a guy called Anna Van Kesteren, wrote a little blog flaming the hell out of Microsoft, saying they did this stuff differently, and they put out, on top of that, a recommendation to do stuff which is not compatible with what anyone else does. It's true. What they recommended is something that won't actually work in the other browsers that have been developing this stuff and making it happen. What they implemented is probably a good idea. It would be good if we sat down and agreed that. But putting out the documentation and the explanation of how to do stuff without talking to the other people who are implementing it, without actually having sat down and said to the different browsers, this is what we're thinking, what does it look like, it's not so helpful. The point of having a standards process, one of the nice things you get out of an open process is, without giving away the farm, you can actually walk in and say, well, you guys are implementing this stuff. We're planning on suggesting people do it like this. Is that, are we on the right track? And when you don't do that, when you go away and implement in a corner, then, you interpret the spec differently. It was written by people, right? I mean, we three are obviously very, very clever.
Well,
I'm not, but
those
three.
I don't know about you guys.
But, occasionally when we write stuff, it's not actually crystal clear to everybody. People don't actually interpret it the same way. So what it really takes is the company's actually talking, participating in the standards process for real, and checking their stuff, showing betas, doing what IE8 does, giving you a beta that you can look at, that a million people can go and say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't how I thought it was. And that includes us looking at it, and vice versa.
Well, well, so to be fair too, the issue around accessibility was actually, we followed a pattern that we follow with pretty much all of our object model properties, and apparently it's not actually that way, and it was a mistake. But we document what we do, so we actually documented it, and that was where the recommendation came from. I think actually on the same front, what I think is really critically important right now, and I know my co-chair for the HTML5 working group agrees with me, is that we do have test suites for all of the standards. And that's been something that we haven't done well enough, particularly with W3C standards in the past, which is why the same time we did the beta, we actually contributed the CSS 2.1 test cases that we built to test our new layout engine to the W3C, actually just to the public, basically. It's offered under a BSD license, so anyone can take them. And we wanted to make sure that we started having a comprehensive test suite so that we could test and make sure that we all got the same understanding of what padding, border, and margin are supposed to do in a number of different cases. And in fact, that's already turned up a bunch of interesting cases where the other browsers have looked at those test cases and in a few places have said, we don't think you're doing the right interpretation here. You know, the spec was slightly ambiguous. We did something different, and we think this is the right interpretation. So we have to resolve all of those now.
And here comes the ad from
and
Dan.
And here's my co-chair right now.
Hi, Dan Connolly. I'm from W3C, and I'm here to help. No.
Hi, Dan.
Oh, so what does it take for margins and stuff to work? Yeah, a lot of times it does come down to good test suites because developers read specs and their eyes glaze over and then they build something and who knows what. But with a test case, it's pretty black and white, you know, whether they got it right or not. So I would like to learn, I would like someone to show me the test case that you know, make me a document where the one browser does it right and the other browser does it wrong or something like that. So there's two opportunities while I'm here in Austin. One is 8 o'clock tonight, and that one might be more virtual than in person. The other one is lunch tomorrow. I don't know if we're going to find the brick oven or someplace in this building or whatever. Somebody come and help me find a venue. And I'm going to try to get a few people in the room and get some momentum, a little bit more momentum on test suites and stuff. Because we got various bits going on, but it's not all headed in the same direction and stuff. So I'd like a lot of help with that. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Dan. So it looks like we have about 5 minutes on the clock. I'm not seeing a lot of other people queuing up. Oh, there is a gentleman queuing up. Sure. Go for it.
One more question.
This is for Chris, too. Any update to the JavaScript debugger tools coming out anytime soon?
Yes. So all of the presentations from the Mix conference last week are online. Please go take a look. We actually, one of the things that we did as part of Beta 1 was release the first beta of our developer tools as well, which we've actually built into IE now. So every IE8 install gets the developer tools, and they're, you know, one click away effectively. And that includes JavaScript debugging tools and object model debugging, as well as CSS and HTML.
It's probably time to conclude. And if you guys didn't all look so awkward, I'd make you do a group hug. you know, but I will say that you know, the I guess it was kind of a bummer in 96 when we talked a lot of smack about each other. When I was part of Netscape, I did talk a lot of smack about Microsoft, and times have changed. I did use the word war for melodramatic effect. There's still a lot of contention, but they're more like skirmishes. And sure, some of them may go to court, but some of them may not.
conflicts, so, if you will.
You know, thank you everybody for coming out and for attending this panel. I've been asked to also ask you guys to fill out those little green pieces of paper. Thank you very much. This is what makes it great.